The following message is copyrighted by Westminster Theological Seminary. Duplication, distribution, or other use of all or any part of this message is not permitted without prior written consent. Please direct your inquiries to communications@wts.edu. For all other information, please visit the main website at www.wts.edu.
Our guest this morning is Reverend Jim Knutson. You will note by that name, Jim is not Dutch, and nor is he Scotch. Jim is the Secretary for Africa of the American Lutheran Church, and he has been here on campus. If you ever wander down in the basement of the library, he's sort of right in the middle of it all. He's been here on study leave from the American Lutheran Church, and something which I would commend to some of you to push in your any boards you're coming from. But he was given a 3-4 months study leave of absence, and he has spent it here on the campus at Westminster, working with several of us in the area, with Orlando Costas at Eastern and Ron Sider and myself. Doing research in areas of African theology, church mission relations, things like that. And we enjoyed his fellowship, and I've asked him if he'd come and spend these 2 hours with us talking about the Africa, giving us as large a picture as he could of the church there. Before he took this job on, which, when was it, about 70? 73. He was 17 and a half years in South Africa. And some of you, I think, remember David Bosch being on campus here last semester, and those are the kinds of circles that Jim travels in, and those are where his concerns lie. So, Jim, Lord bless you.
Well, it's a real privilege for me to be here, and I mean that. I'm used to visiting the campuses of Luther Seminary in St. Paul, Wartburg Seminary in Dubuque, and Trinity Seminary in Columbus, Ohio, but not Presbyterian seminaries. And it really is a privilege. Harvey asked me to talk about Africa, and I said I would try to do that, and I would mainly use a presentation that I had used last summer at a conference at St. Olaf College in Northfield, Minnesota. A broad outline of Africa and something of the church's involvement there. Then yesterday I was over there in the student center having my sandwich and coffee, and I heard someone make a statement something like this: due to a mistaken notion, this is what the Lutherans teach. So I thought maybe I'd better spend this time trying to straighten you people out as to, we may be wrong, but you aren't mistaken. But but I didn't quite have time to go into that, and I think I'm on a little safer ground if I stick with Africa. So, I should say from the outset that my aim is a real general survey of Africa, and that's a dangerous thing to do, and then a real general survey of the church in Africa, and I'll qualify that as I go along. In other words, I'm not going to be talking at this point about the American Lutheran Church, the Division for World Mission and Interchurch Cooperation, in which I work, our policies, our stance, all of you very happy to answer questions. So I'm not talking much about the American church and about its view of mission, but rather Africa and the churches there with whom we work. Well, I'm sure that some of you have been in Africa, and I know that you all have images and ideas and pictures of Africa. Cecil Northcott, in a very good little book, which is still helpful, called Christianity in Africa, made the statement, every man has his Africa. Of course, now you can't say that anymore. You have to say every person has his, her own Africa. And I think that's true. But in other words, we all have some images of Africa. If you ask Sunday school kids, they say it's Tarzan and it's the jungles. Today, perhaps more of you would have a picture of wars, of coups, of desert, of famine. Maybe other pictures you have through friends, through missionaries you know. But we all have some picture of Africa. My image has been shaped, as you have heard, by living there. My wife and I went out as newlyweds in 1954 and served in South Africa with the Lutheran Church, and then now as Africa Secretary. Well, this time doesn't make me an expert on Africa any more than 27 years of work in the church in America makes a person an expert on the American church. But it gives you some perspectives. It gives you some lenses. And my lenses, of course, are Lutheran and they're American. And I think we could even separate those two, because both of them give me a particular, peculiar perspective, being Lutheran and being American. And I think that the American part we all have in common in relationship to Africa. And as far as Lutheran or Presbyterian, I don't think the experiences that we have and the churches with whom we work are all that much different. So I think that what I say will be fairly relevant to all of you here. I know how difficult it is to generalize. It's terribly dangerous, but I have to try and do it. To sketch with a few broad strokes something of the context in which our Christian brothers and sisters in Africa are living and working. Well, how do you generalize about a continent that is 3 times the size of the United States? Unfortunately, the map that I've been carrying around all year, I left home when I went back for the board meeting, but you know the shape of the continent. 3 times the size of the United States. There are 51 nations. Some of them are very tiny, some are very large. There are anywhere from 1,000 to 1,600 languages, and you see different numbers. And then there are thousands of dialects. I mean, thousands, because there are groupings of people, sometimes 5,000, 6,000, one language, and you move over into the next valley, it's another language. There are about 440 million people. That number varies a little bit, but I think that's a fairly good estimate. And of course, as you know, this is a continent that's been undergoing tremendous changes in the last 20, 30 years. It's been telescoping and accelerating so that you almost hesitate to say anything about it. And there are deep, striking contrasts in the whole continent. So now let's try to talk a little bit about some of this context. And the one thing I would say at this time is that I'm mainly talking about sub-Saharan Africa, and that's a big enough bite to chew off. I do not have any direct relationship or involvement in North Africa. We are not involved very heavily at all as a church there. I guess that's not unique. But anyway, we're talking about sub-Saharan Africa. First of all, the political changes. Just a brief word about the political situation. You are a little bit younger than well, some of you are, but when many of us went to school, we learned about Nyasaland, Northern and Southern Rhodesia, Belgian Congo, Bechuanaland, Basutoland, Lorenzo Marx, Fort Lamy. You can't find any of those on a map now, none of those. In fact, there have been a few changes just, I think, since the time that I first gave this presentation last summer. The map has changed continually, and especially 60-61, the tremendous number of nations who were given political independence around 60-61. Today, all nations in Africa are politically independent except Namibia, and of course, that whole struggle is going on these days. Some of you may be following it in the papers, if there are questions, we can talk about that later. And then, of course, the blacks of South Africa, and that's another whole situation by itself. Those are the two groups, you might say, that do not have, at least in theory, have political independence. In the last 20 years, there have been coups, wars, uprisings, political ferment. And I know some people say, oh man, Africa, you know, what a mess. But in one sense, as far as wars and coups and uprisings, that's no different from the history of Europe and the United States. That part, not at all. We forget. We forget the history of Europe, and we just go back and read about the 30 Years' War and all those things that happened, to say nothing of our own history and the wars in which we have been involved. But there have been some built-in problems in the African situation that probably led to more of this, and also, of course, it has been telescoped again and pushed together in a relatively short period of time. One thing, the borders of the countries. Now, as some of you know, those borders were drawn up in Europe at a conference in 1885 in Berlin. Originally, as the European explorers began to move around Africa, they established beachheads or bridgeheads on the coast. And so you'd have one city that, or one port that was occupied by the French, another by the Portuguese, another by the British, another by the Germans. And then they kind of moved inland along the rivers, and so you look at those early maps and you see a little bit sticking in here and a little bit here and a little bit here, not much in the interior. And of course, Africa at that time was wide open for all kinds of things, and they looked at it in terms of their own political situation and their own home situation. And so finally, when they sat down in Berlin, they began to draw the lines. and they kind of drew them in from where they were, and they started carving up Africa. Well, a couple things. The line, the borders often went right through the what we call tribes. Now, tribes is a word that we have to be careful with today. Our African brothers remind us of that, that in a sense, we are all tribes, and we shouldn't use it in a derogatory sense, that tribes belong to something primitive or something, you know, less sophisticated. But in, we use that, it went through groupings of people, and it carved out, often carved out economic units, because they just sat there, and they, the story is that, well, the British took this part, and the French took this part, and well, then the Portuguese ended up, you know, with Angola and Mozambique. And then the Belgian king said, well, what's for me? And they said, well, you can have that piece in the middle. So he got Belgian Congo. That's just about the way it went. Today, Zaire. I mean, without any regard to the situation there. And if we'd been there, we'd have been doing the same thing. We're not criticizing our European brothers and sisters. We would have been doing the same thing if we had been there. But we weren't in that game at that time. Africa was not a place where the United States was involved. Well, the units then were not often units with viable economy, and then they were looked upon, and of course this is natural. I mean, this is the way we looked at the world in those days. They were looked upon as sources for crops, for food, possibly eventually for minerals or for resources of various kinds. And of course then this began to develop later on, that there was indeed, there were a lot of riches in Africa, and today we know that there are 87% of the cobalt of the world, 61% of the gold, 45% of the platinum, 70% of the diamonds, 35% of uranium. These are the kind of resources Africa has. So at that time, they didn't see that fully, but they were aware of the fact that here's wealth. Well, of course, also as they looked at Africa, they saw it somewhat in terms of a strategic location. At that time, not in terms of the oil fields like we see it today, but the route, the sea routes to the east, to the Dutch East Indies. And in a side, you know that the Dutch went and settled there, or didn't even settle, the Dutch set up a wayfaring station at Cape Town in order to refuel and to give fresh water and vegetables to the ships going to the far more important area in the East Indies. That's where they were going, East Indies. South Africa was a way station. That's how they got started. Well, anyway, as we see the background of this, you can see in a way that it's not surprising from a political standpoint that we have these problems today of with borders going through tribes, with uneconomic units, with it being looked at as a place from which you would take things away. And so today, of course, we have the situation of wars on many fronts in Namibia, in Angola, in Chad, Western Sahara, Uganda's. Well, Harvey can tell you more about that than I can. And you can go on. Somalia, Eritrea. It's not surprising that even today we have this kind of a situation. And by the way, this has its impact on the churches, and we're not talking about the churches yet, but the political situation rebounds on the churches every once in a while. And just last night, I had a phone call from a man in our office who wanted to tell me they had received word that the government of Ethiopia had come to the leaders of the church in Ethiopia. It's a Lutheran church and also Presbyterian. Presbyterians are working together there. The Ethiopian Evangelical Church Makaniesis. And it told them that by today at 4 o'clock they had to be out of their church offices. They were taking over the offices, government. And you have to be out. Well, there are all kinds of things. And this is just one example of what is happening in some places because of the political situation. Okay, the political situation is one. And then not unrelated is the economic situation, that 18 of the 25 poorest countries in the world are in Africa. And I gave you one of those clippings from the AF press clips just to give you an illustration of that. Some people say that per capita income in Africa is $365 per person. It's probably less in most countries. And of course that has to be interpreted. If you are living on the land and have fields and have gardens and have some cows and some goats and some chickens, you don't need a lot of cash income. But still, it gives one basis for comparison. The fact that today Africa is being hit by high inflation, now it's not as high as Latin America, but I've seen a figure of 21% average inflation. Some places it's higher. That's bad. I mean, we would holler like everything if we had it, but I know it's not as bad as some of the Latin American nations. in Africa, it will be higher and, of course, in lower depending on the place. They're paying $5, $6 a gallon for gas in a lot of those countries. And I can't complain when I go to a gas pump. I just can't. I can't. Even some of our friends in West Africa paying $2.50, $3 a gallon is bad enough, but it's $5, $6, and I don't know, in a place like Uganda where you can't even get it, and it's black market. But I'm thinking of Tanzania, for instance. I think it's about $5, $6, and that's regular price at the pump when you can get it. Well, also the exchange matter then, we're told now that 60% of Tanzanians' foreign exchange goes for oil. It was 10% for less oil, so that these countries get caught in this oil bind, and that more and more of their foreign exchange has to go for oil. Also in the economic sphere, they're importing food, and I think there was a mention of that in that article, and there's another one that followed, which came a couple days later. It called For Many Millions, Empty Hopes and Empty Bellies, telling about how Africa has to increasingly import food. It was once completely self-sufficient. Obviously, there were problems, but it didn't import any food. Then in 1960, it was 95% self-sufficient. Now the dependence is growing year by year. And certainly the wars and the political unrest contribute to this, no doubt about it. But also the drought. First in the West, you remember in the early 70s, a tremendous drought in the Sahara, the Sahel, on the edge of the Sahara. That has leveled off somewhat for now, but right now it's been much worse in the east. And I know some of you are quite aware what has been happening in Kenya, in northern Kenya, in Somalia, in Ethiopia, parts of Tanzania. It is said now that 6 out of 10 Africans go to bed hungry at night, and that 1 in 5 of the children, or 1 in 5 of the people rather, are malnourished. And of course this is mostly children. And the frightening thing about this is, and I'm telling you a lot of things you know, but just to get the picture, that you know that for children this causes permanent brain damage, permanent deficiency. So that it's a frightening thing to realize that there are many young people in Africa, many children, and who will never develop their full mental capabilities. And what this means for the future, you're almost afraid to think. So we have that whole problem. Now, obviously, I'm not even attempting to talk about any even beginnings of solutions. I'm sketching the problem, and we can touch probably on some of those things later. Also, in this area of economics and hunger and drought, Africa has the most refugees today of any continent, we're told. 5 million refugees. Africa has 12% of the world's population, but at the moment it has half of the world's refugees, much more than in Southeast Asia. And of course, we have been criticized by the fact we pay so much attention to the refugees in Southeast Asia, and then we don't do always what we should, that we have not been that much concerned about the refugee situation in Africa. That's a very complicated and complex problem. I don't think the answer to that problem in Africa is to start shipping African refugees to the States either, so it's not easy. But these are especially in the area of Somalia because of the wars in Ethiopia, the war in Uganda, of course the war in Southern Africa, the Namibian situation. There has been some resettlement of refugees now back into Angola and back into Mozambique, especially Mozambique, back into Zimbabwe, the old Rhodesia. So there has been some resettlement because wars have been, there have been settlements in some of those situations. Maybe a picture of this is what somebody said, that when the refugees now, especially who have come to Somalia, it is if the entire population of the United Kingdom would show up on the east coast of the United States with only the clothes on their back and one half of them being sick. This is what Somalia has been facing. And Paul Hartling, the UN High Commissioner for Refugees, because it's been the UN High Commissioner for Refugees which has dealt mainly with the Somalian thing and has gotten help from others, tribute must be paid to those who acted so generously, a generosity rooted in African hospitality. And he's speaking of Somalia, Sudan, and Tanzania. Those countries have accepted the refugees. Somalia, Sudan, Tanzania, especially from this situation. And it really is something when you think of these poor countries accepting these refugees. I don't want to make any comparisons. I could get kind of a little bit bitter and a little bit cynical if I wanted to. About, again, it's a difficult situation. But when these countries show this kind of hospitality, this kind of openness, and then we're so afraid that a few more are going to lower our standard of living a little bit and hurt us that we have to, you know, it's kind of frightening. Another aspect now of the context, moving on from the economic context, they're all interrelated, obviously. I mean, they're just woven together. The matter of health care, the lack of basic health care facilities. Now, I don't know what figures you have in that thing I gave you, and you get different figures, but the ones I had picked up earlier were 15 to 20,000 Africans per doctor. Now, this varies. There are places where it'll be lower and places it'll be higher. And obviously, there are medical assistants, there are dispensary people who run dispensaries out in the bush, and it doesn't mean that everybody who's sick needs to go to a doctor. That's something we have to learn here too, and I guess we're learning it. You don't always need an MD, and even the MDs are telling us that now. This one book that a doctor wrote about helping yourself or healing yourself, he said a lot of stuff you can just help yourself with. But anyway, this gives you an idea of the healthcare. 150,000 per dentist. Well, dentistry, that's just, I mean, that's out. Originally I would say, I suppose the African people eating meat and eating greens and so forth didn't have the dental problems that we do, or maybe that they even do now. They chew on branches instead of brushing their teeth, which is a very good way. You see a guy or a woman walking down the road just chewing on a branch. It's a good way to clean your teeth. But when you do get a toothache, like I did once in West Africa, I was fortunate that the only dentist for about 700 miles was an SIM dentist, and we were driving right by there. It was in Niger, and we were going right by that place, and he did a root canal on me there, and I was pretty glad that one of those few dentists was on the road. But for most Africans, you know, they don't have this. The highest infant mortality in the world, and the figure I have is 137 out of 1,000. Life expectancy is 43, compared with 53 in the world and 71 in the U.S. Again, the figures can be, you know, off, but I think the basis of comparison is the important thing, so that the healthcare needs are really something tremendous. Another aspect here is literacy. Now, we get figures of 10 to 15 to 20% people who are literate. That varies. There are countries where 5% of the people are literate, 10%. Mostly, you'd find adults would not be literate. Well, you can say, you know, so what? Don't need to read. But as the world moves and changes, it gets more and more difficult to not be able to read or to have a basic understanding of at least some very simple things that are going on. Well, these are just some very, very brief sketches, and there are some of the things you read in that article. And then you add to all of this, I guess, one more important thing. This is a changing, swirling complex of problems and challenges, and there's one more thing that runs through it all. That is the fact that on the tip, there may be several things that run through, but the thing I'm going to mention, on the tip of Africa, a minority of 4.5 million white people dominate a majority of 22 million black people through the legal system, or what they call a legal system of apartheid. And they also illegally occupy Namibia. There is an overriding abhorrence of this throughout Africa. If there's one thing that unites Africa, this is it. They might argue about all kinds of stuff. And they get to the OAU, and they could never agree perhaps on sanctions against Amin, or they could not agree on what they should say to Gaddafi of Libya, but they could all agree on what they want to say about the situation in South Africa. For instance, an example of this, last summer, I believe it was early summer, this summer rather, there was an African delegation that visited Kansas. They were invited by Nancy Kassebaum, the senator who is chairman of the House Foreign Relations Committee. I believe she is, yeah. I know she's on the Africa subcommittee, but I think she's chairman. And the basic aim of that visit to Kansas was to learn more about food production. And the people who were there expressed their gratitude in learning something. I've I've since learned that Nigeria especially is looking to the United States for help in food production. They really want to get some help from us. Not aid, but help in food production. But they told Nancy Kassenbaum, our overriding concern is with the political issues raised by South Africa. Thanks for the help about food production, but don't forget, in your position in the United States Senate, what we're concerned about. And I think you find this all over. Even though some of them will be trading with South Africa under the table, they have to live. The whole Southern Africa is dependent on them, and they have to import especially corn. But still, so this issue, and I'm not going to spend any more time on the Southern Africa thing now. If there's time for questions, we can certainly talk about it. But to just paint this general context, we have to keep in mind that this is the thing that unites them. Now, in all of this, we have to keep in mind that there is a meeting of cultures or a clash of cultures through all of this. The impact of the West on Africa is really the onslaught of the West on Africa is something, too, that we need to look at when we try to interpret the context. To see the transistors in the grass huts, in the mud huts, I mean, that blows your mind. Even when we first went to Africa, you know, there were no transistors in the 50s, and you didn't see this. Now you can be way, 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 way out in the bush somewhere, and you see just what you see in Philadelphia, somebody going along the road carrying one of these transistors, listening to it. Blows your mind. I mean, they may have nothing else, really, that's really what we would call part of our civilization. I mean, they may dress like us, they may not, but the transistor radio. And here they can listen to, well, if they've got a powerful one, they can listen to any place in the world. And of course, everybody is trying to capitalize on it. Everybody from Russia to China to us to everybody under the sun. Many, many people in Africa have never ridden in a car. Some have ridden in a bus or a train. But every day they see the jets going overhead, flying back and forth from Europe to Africa. They see the satellites at night. In fact, you can see them much better when you're out in the bush in Africa than you can with our lighted sky. And I used to marvel when I visited Swaziland. That was in the 60s. I visited there quite often, kind of with the height of the satellite thing. And never failed when I was sitting there outside the pastor's house seeing satellites at night because it was so easy and the sky is so dark. What do you think about how you put all this together, you know? Well, the impact on Africa has been, it's really, in a short time, has been called by some people unequaled in history, the impact of the West. There's been impact in Asia and other places. The political, the military, the economic impact, and of course the slave trade, another whole piece, which as Africans look at their history and look at themselves, comes out in their thinking. And the thing about that was, as John Mbiti has said, and many others, and we'll mention John Mbiti later when we talk about theology in African context, we were made to believe the West was omnipotent and we were omni-weak, that the West was omniscient and we were omni-ignorant, that they were superior and we were inferior. This was the whole thrust. And again, it's no different from the thrust in the States with our original inhabitants of this country. I mean, we came to really make use of this land, to really properly make use of it. They weren't doing the proper thing. We had the way. We had the proper way, the correct way. So the history is, there are some real analogies in the history. But Africa has been absorbing this kind of thing for these centuries. And now they're seeking to sort this out. Dr. Thomas Odihambo of Kenya spoke at the WCC Conference on Faith, Science, and the Future at MIT in 1979 and made this statement, which I think sums up their struggle. This, then, is the great dilemma of the new leadership of Africa, how to initiate and sustain development in the industrial sense of the West, while at the same time keeping the social and cultural fabric of the African people, or in another way, how to add an industrial dimension to our lives while keeping intact the essence of the African ethos. That's the end of that quote. Now, he's not talking about the church, all you could think about the church in this context, too. And this is the end of the first, not necessarily half in terms of time, but the first section of the presentation. And maybe we could stop here just for a couple minutes, although I think if it goes too long, we'll go to the second part and then kind of take it all at the end. But if there are a couple comments or questions now, we could take them, and then we could start on the second one, and then we'll take a break in any case in the middle of our time. Yes?
Yes, you said that once Africa was completely self-sufficient,
yeah,
economically, is malnutrition still a problem?
Well, I think, you know, there's history that we don't know, but I think we have to honestly say there certainly were droughts, because even the droughts that are incurring now, especially in the, well, across the Sahara and the Sahel, they say they're cyclical, that they will come back again, just like our periods. So there were droughts, there probably were famines, but I think a couple of things have to be remembered. There were less people, so there was less pressure on the land, certainly in east and south, which I know a little bit better. When you see the concentration of people in Kenya, when you fly over parts of Kenya, you know, it just blows your mind. Certainly in southern Africa, there were fewer people, so that you could have your land. After a few years, you moved on. You didn't have to work so, you know, on crop rotation or replenishing the soil. You moved on, and maybe after so many years, you could come back there again. There was land for the cattle to graze. There were more wild animals. People lived, I know, in southern Africa, a lot of them lived, you know, their meat supply partly was wild game. So I think, in a way, I wonder if there was as much malnutrition. I think they had a better balanced diet. Now certain segments of that have been cut out, so you find that they live on cassava, or they live on mealies, corn, or they live on guinea corn. And they don't have the greens or the meat and other things to supplement that. So when we talk about this, it's you know, one has to qualify. There are places in Africa today where you go. I think of parts of Cameroon, Central African Republic, parts of Nigeria, and the people you got in the villages, and they have their fields, they have their flocks, and they're on that level. They're not starving. They're getting along. But gradually around the edges, and then it's a rather fragile thing, and especially on the edges of the desert, when you get drought or you get war, then the whole thing is upset, and then you have this malnutrition and all these things kind of snowball and interact. You can get full of, especially like starch, and in fact, you get the bloated. You know, you get a certain, and I'm no expert in this at all, but you see people actually when they're real bloated, then it is malnutrition. But even if they're living on starch, like in southern Africa, it's a lot of corn. And they look sort of, you know, fat. Or of course, it'll show up sometimes in the hair. The hair will get orangey. That's one way you can see it. They may look okay here, but they have orangey hair, and you can spot it. And it's a protein deficiency called kwashiorkor that they will often have, and that is growing in South Africa, in spite of a lot of things that are happening. There are more of those kind of cases than ever. Well, you know the situation in Uganda. I mean, that was caused basically by one crazy man. That's oversimplifying it. But Ethiopia, the war there, excuse me, was caused by the history of that country, where Ethiopia really, as a nation, reached out. I mean, Ethiopia as a nation is an old nation, but in the sense of its present boundaries, is fairly new. And so it incorporated Eritrea, and Eritrea didn't want to be incorporated. And so there was a war. It was given the Ogaden, and I wish we had a map, but the part of the eastern part towards Somalia, it was given that land, and yet most of the people there were ethnic Somalis. It was given that by the Europeans. They drew the border, you know, the Horn of Africa comes here, and I don't know, Somalia is kind of in here, and they were just given a piece of land here, which really contains ethnic Somalis, and Somalia has always maintained that's theirs. And yet the OAU, the Organization for African Unity, has said we must respect those boundaries as bad as they are, because once we start tinkering with them, there's no end. And so here you have a case of really where a boundary went through a people. That was the cause of that one. The Namibian War, of course, or Angola War, is because of South Africa's illegal occupation of Namibia, and then everybody got in the act. The Angolans called in the Cubans to help them, and you know, that's because of the political situation there, not so much of the famine. The war in Chad, I would say, is mostly political. Libya wants to control Chad, which is beneath it, So I'd say it's probably more political than famine, and it's not even always so much economic, because some of those areas aren't all that viable economically. Now, there are places where they think, well, maybe there's oil under there, maybe there's something under there. Sometimes it's just to control the land. So there are a variety of reasons. Now, you have the thing you talk about happening in countries, either along borders or within the countries themselves. That happens. I remember in Ethiopia, and I'll never forget it, because we were on the edge of the desert in eastern Ethiopia when we got in the middle, well, not in the middle, but right close to the middle of one of these where there's feuding back and forth all the time. And that just gets to be feuding. It doesn't even get to be for water holes. One time, a group of Afar people in the desert will raid the Gala people in the foothills and steal their cattle and their goats and stab people. If they can kill them, they'll kill them. Then about a month or two later, it's the other way around. And we were there a mile away from a village that they invaded one night. And we came to that village the next morning, and it was terrible. They had killed a couple people. They'd stabbed a bunch of the kids. They just run into the huts and stabbed them. So there's this kind of thing going on too, the feuds, you know. But otherwise, on the broader scene, it's not so much that. The Western, and in this case it was European nations, did not prepare. The worst example was Zaire, Belgian Congo, and the two Portuguese, the Angola, Mozambique. They were the worst as far as preparing. There are some statistics I can't remember, like, you know, one or two lawyers in the country when it gets independence, and Angola and Zaire had a very, very few people, hardly anyone with a BA degree or any kind of similar education, so that they weren't preparing these countries for independence, because that wasn't the mood. But then after World War II, the mood came. It started in India and it came across. And then they realized they had to give this independence, and they couldn't hold it back, and they hadn't prepared people in the meantime. You know, they couldn't stop it, and it would have been wrong. But the countries weren't prepared. So you have, in a sense, you have political independence, you have economic dependence, and then there's a whole other area that I haven't touched on here. It's a sense neocolonialism through the economic system of the world. And then you have this Cancun consultation in Mexico about 2 weeks ago, Reagan was there, where the nations are talking, you know, about the north-south, the dichotomy between north and south. The Brandt Commission, this report that was chaired by Willy Brandt, where they say that the whole thing is out of whack. We got into the game. The circle was already made, and we can't get into it. It's controlled by the powerful nations of the West, of America and Europe. They run the whole world economy. They decide on the prices for commodities. They decide, you know, they can control what price is paid for coffee, for copper, for cobalt, for anything, for cocoa, for peanuts. We have to take whatever the price is. They set the tariffs. If we manufacture stuff, they put the tariffs up. And so this whole thing, you know, it's a part of this. It's, in a sense, they are claiming that it's economic neocolonialism, even though politically they're free. And to a large degree, they're right. And that's a tough problem. That is really, when you get into that, that's much tougher than just sending food aid to people who are starving. A couple things I can say. One is that, to some extent, the white elite, if you want to call it that, who ran the countries, both politically and economically, have been replaced by a black elite. And there are some very fine African leaders. But you have, in a sense, just a switch. And the rest of the system didn't change that much. To be fair, I think it's true to say that many of these black elite really aren't too concerned. In fact, this article, the one I just read last night, because this series has continued in a couple of these, where it says, for instance, the African leaders have not been concerned about training people in the agricultural sector. They've not, and people have not been interested, because agriculture in Africa is sort of like it used to be here, you know, down on the farm. That's a place you want to get away from. You know, that was that. You look down on farmers. And in my generation, I didn't, because I grew up in a small town, and my dad made his living. He had a small store. He made his living from farmers, and I worked on farms. But still, you know, even then, you know, the kids that came in from the country to go to school, that image we don't have anymore. You can't tell. In fact, maybe there's farmers that have the biggest cars, and you know. But in Africa, that's some place to get away from. So people don't want to study agriculture. They don't want to study, I would say, I'd also, I think I could say, that they're not so interested in the and the technical skills and vocational skills, because the image has been, and I'm overstating it, but I think it's true, and I've heard Africans say it, the image has been, the goal has been to get away from that, to get a suit and a tie and sit behind a desk, like they saw the white people doing. I mean, why not? The white people weren't out there doing that kind of work. They were sitting behind desks. There were exceptions. So there's a syndrome, I think, of where René Dumont is a if anyone is interested in agriculture or in the development, he's a French agronomist who wrote False Start in Africa. False Start in Africa. Now he has been invited by these countries to be a consultant, and they have not accepted his findings. You know, so that happens in many countries, because he goes right to the heart of it. He says, you've got to train people in agriculture, you've got to put more of your budget in agricultural development, you've got to get people out in the field, you can't just sit here and kind of run the bureaucracy up on top, because your problem is food production, and you can increase your food production not by getting more necessary direct aid from overseas, but by training people. So I think there has been a tendency for in that direction of not training people with those kind of skills. Now, on the other hand, one must say that certainly there have been a number of people sent overseas, and people have been trained, but I think it's tended to be more out of the practical line. There are attempts, I think, to turn the corner on this. I think it'll slowly come. So you start with, I think this is where the beauty of the church's involvement, we can just jump for a minute to I think of some models I've seen, and where a church agriculture project will just work in a few villages and work with the people in those villages, trying to help them improve their production right there. And as opposed to some of the big projects where they come in, put in a great big dam, and it benefits a few people. And this debate is still going on now. There's going to be a big dam put in the Senegal River. And I hear that there is a real, real hot debate. Some people point to the Aswan Dam and say, look at all the damage it's caused, and dams aren't the answer. But, a thing like this gets in the works, and it takes 10, 15 years for it to finally get going, and you can't stop it. So, but I think this is the beauty of what the church is doing. It's lighting a few candles, a few little lights in the darkness. In many places in Africa, you go out and you find the church agriculturalist, whether he's an expatriate or African, right out there with the people, working in the villages, helping them to improve their production. And of course, the most exciting models, and there aren't that many, and I have not seen a lot, but the exciting ones are where they try to integrate this then with healthcare and with maybe some literacy training. And I'm obviously saying these people are doing it in the name of Jesus Christ, and they're talking about Jesus. They're naming the name too. I sound like I'm somebody from USAID here, I guess. I'm taking for granted that the people we send as a church are committed Christians whose concern is that people be brought into fellowship with Jesus Christ. But that's you can't leave it there. If the man is hungry, and if the woman is sick, and if the kid is dying, you can't say, accept Jesus Christ and then go on to the next village. You work, and we'll talk about that when we come to the next. But I think that the church has an opportunity to work with these kind of models, where you work in the village with agriculture production, with healthcare, which includes sanitation, which is getting more and more a problem as people get more packed together, with some literacy, and because it's a total development of the total person. And you mentioned the Africans have an insight into this, which we can learn from. You just don't deal with one aspect of people.